All right. We're holding on page 126 in Shabbos, the last line, Ois Tzadik Galad. We started talking about yesterday about all about bloodletting, which in those times they had, it was a common thing to do every so often. It was considered a medical treatment. And so the Gemara was discussing the point you have to eat. So you have to eat right after it, and you have to eat certain kinds of foods that help restore your strength. And you also have to warm. You also have to warm the person. You also have to do something to warm the person up. So continuing on that topic, Amar Shmuel, Pursa de Dama Kol Tlosin Yoimin. The schedule, how often you should do bloodletting is every 30 days. Bein Aprakim. Then once a person reaches the point between two stages of his life, Rashi explains that means when he reaches 40 years old, you might, then he should reduce the frequency and do it, Rashi says, only once every other month. Because as a person gets older, they don't need bloodletting as much. Their body heat is cooling off, their whatever, and then therefore, and their strength is starting to weaken, and therefore, yeah. Uvena prukim, and then after yet another stage in life, which Rashi says is after 60, yachzibi might, then he should make it still less often, only once every 3 months. Different other Rishonim have different other, Rabbein Hananel has, and different other Rishonim have different definitions of the Bein HaPrakim over here and how often it should be. But the bottom line is we're saying as a person gets older, they should do it less often. Okay. V'Amar Shmuel, also Shmuel says, Pursa D'Dama, the schedule, the appropriate days of the week to do bloodletting are Chad B'Shabsa, Arba U'Male Shabsa, on Sunday, on Wednesday, and on Friday. But not on Monday and Thursday, and also not, as the Gemara is going to discuss in a second, on Tuesday. So therefore, that only leaves Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. An interesting point is, you think about those are the same days of the week that Rosh Hashanah can't come out on. What the connection is, I mean, it does talk about in some places in Chassidus that Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday are days that are more associated with Chesed, or with aspects of Chesed, and therefore Rosh Hashanah, which is a Yom HaDin, doesn't belong on them so much, so maybe that relates to this over here also. Since those are days of Chesed, then it's fine to do bloodletting on them.
Sunday and what?
Wednesday? Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. So Abel Sheni v'Chamishi loy, but not on Monday and Thursday. A braisa says that only somebody who has zchus of his ancestors, in other words, only somebody who has tremendous zchusim to rely on, he can let blood on Mondays and Thursdays because those are actually days of din. Shabastin shomaylov shomata shavin kachad, both the bastin on high in Shemayim and the Beis Din down here on earth sit on those days, because the Beis Din Shomayla is in session every day, Odom Nidin Mechol Yoyim, and the Beis Din on earth, Ezra made a takana, that they sit particularly on Mondays and Thursdays. Before that, Tosfos points out that they didn't necessarily have, they would gather together a Beis Din whenever they needed it. They didn't necessarily have a fixed schedule. Ezra made a fixed schedule Mondays and Thursdays. So therefore, Mondays and Thursdays are particularly days of Din, and therefore it's not a good idea to be doing bloodletting on those days. This is also, by the way, the fact that those are days of din is why we say extra tachnun on those days. I mean, there's also the point that's mentioned. On the other hand, there are days of rachamim. There's a whole story that the Kolboy tells involving people who were threatened by with being burnt by the stake or something by the government. There was a terrible gzera against Jews, and then certain people had a dream where they saw in a dream psukim that they're going to be saved from it. And the Kolboy tells a whole long story about it. And then the upshot is when these people were about to be taken out to be executed, or when they were in the fire, whatever, they were saying the various parts of Uhur Rachum, and therefore the Chachamim established to say Uhur Rachum on Mondays and Thursdays, which are special Yimei Rachamim. Here we're saying they're more Yimei Din, but okay, it could be both. You know, they start out as Yimei Din, but then we say Tachnun, and that evokes Hashem's Rachamim. But still, as far as bloodletting, not a good idea. Okay, the Gemara says, but Tlos of the Shabbos of my time alloy, why not do bloodletting on Tuesday? And the reason is Mishum Dekaimele Madim Bezovi, because Madim is during the even hours of the day. And here we need to discuss, which Rashi gives at some length over here, the matter of the mazolos of the hours. So the most common thing we come across it, as we know, there's the minhag not to make kiddush between approximately 6 and 7 on Friday night because mazol Madim. So the idea is like this. You have 7 major mazolos for this purpose. You have the 7 major moving heavenly bodies, the sun, the moon, and the five inner planets up to and including Saturn. So not counting Uranus and Neptune and possibly Pluto, because those aren't even visible to the naked eye. But there's the idea each of them has a certain hashpa on the world. And there's the idea that each one has a hashpa for 1 hour and then the next one takes over. So we're not talking about something that has to do with their orbits or something like that. We're not talking about something involving their physical positions. This is more of a metaphysical kind of thing. Anyway, so you have, so it goes in an order, starting with, starting with, Rashi explains, we start with Tuesday night, that is, going into Wednesday, because Wednesday, after all, the fourth day of creation is when Hashem created these heavenly bodies in the first place. So therefore, the first hour of night going into Wednesday, then the planet that has the most influence is Shamsai, Saturn. The next one is Tzedek, which is Jupiter. The next one further, the next one closer to us, and so forth. And it cycles through the seven of them, ending with Levana, the moon, and then starts over again. So you have 7 hours, and then another 7 hours, and so forth. And since there are 7 days in the week, then it works out each one of them has an influence 24 times during the week. It actually comes out, by the way, if you look into it, it comes out the names of the days of the week, the English names and the English and other Goyish languages, days of the week are actually based on those. Sunday, for example, the first hour of the morning of Sunday, the planet that has to do with that first hour from 6 to 7 Sunday morning is in fact the sun. The first one on Monday morning, from 6 to 7 Monday morning, is the moon, and so forth. In English, it's hard to see the connections with the other ones because they're named after the German equivalents of these various planets. But in French and Spanish and whatnot, you can see it a lot more clearly. In Spanish, for example, Tuesday is Martes, as in like Mars. Wednesday is Miércoles, like Mercury, and so forth. Each one, it actually works out according to the Seder that Rashi mentions over here. Anyway, the point is, therefore, now the Gemara also tells us in Psachim at great length that things involving pairs things involving even numbers of things make a person susceptible to mazikin. So now when you have on Tuesday, when you make this calculation of the influences of the planets hour by hour, it comes out that on Tuesday, during the eighth hour of the day, so from 1 to 2 o'clock and then from 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, then you have the mazel is madin. So therefore you have the combination of it's an even numbered hour because it's the eighth hour of the day and it's Madim, which has to do with war and bloodshed and disaster and whatnot. So therefore it's not a good day to be doing bloodletting. So there's different understandings among the Rishonim. Tosfos doesn't say in so many words, but they seem to imply that it's not so much that during other hours of the day on Tuesday there would be a problem, but if you're going to do it on Tuesday, you might come to do it during that hour, and it could be dangerous. On the other hand, the Ran says it's more along the lines of that when you have a day, when you have such a thing, confluence of Madim with an even-numbered hour, then that whole day automatically is dangerous.
That can overpower the fact that
Tuesday is Keto, Keto? So even though it's Keto, nevertheless, you still have that point. So Tuesday is not a good day to do blooding. Marsha actually brings in, not over here in Chedushe Agadis that we have here printed in the Ein Yaakov, in Chedushe Halochas printed in the back of the Gemara, he brings yet another explanation from Rabbeinu Chananel that what you have is on Tuesday, you actually have twice during the 24 hours of Tuesday, that is to say Monday night and Tuesday day, where you have twice during that 24-hour period where Madam is doing an even-numbered hour, and that means that the whole day, therefore, is off-limits for that. In other words, other days of the week, well, Monday and Thursday, you also have that, but Monday and Thursday, we said, are off-limits for a different reason, because based in Shomata. So therefore, as opposed to certain other days of the week, Shabbos, obviously, you're not doing bloodletting anyway, and Sunday and Wednesday, you don't have that. You only have one time during that 24 hours where it comes out on an odd number, on an even numbered hour, and therefore it's not so bad. Anyway. When did they stop doing bloodletting as a regular medical cure? I don't know, last 200 years, I guess, or so. When did they stop doing this this idea of the planets? I mean, we still have. Again, the reason we don't make Kiddush between 6 and 7 Friday night has to do with this matter of the planetary influences. By the way, when we learned earlier, we had a few days ago the part about the two malachim that accompany a person home. The Avudraham, I think, gives an explanation that relates to that also. You have the hour... an hour before Madim is the hour of Tzedek, of Jupiter, which has a Tzedek has to do with exactly that, tzedakah and benevolence and whatever. So therefore, it's a more appropriate time to bring in Shabbos than Madim, the next hour, which has to do with war and violence and whatnot. And he says that's actually represented by the point about the two malachim, that a better, the two malachim representing, in other words, the two influences of Tzedek and of Madim, they're the ones that accompany a person home. And hopefully you bring in Shabbos with the good one, with Tzedek, rather than with the not such good one, Madim. Okay. So the Gemara asks, "Mala Shabbos Nami Kaima Bezavi? Don't you have, if you calculate it, you come out that on Friday also you have Madim is doing an even numbered hour of the day. If you make the calculation as Rashi does, it comes out that on Friday Madim comes out during the sixth hour of the day, which is from 11 to 12 in the morning. So then, don't you have the same problem, Madim plus an even numbered hour?" Or according to Marsha's explanation from Rabbeinu Hananel, on Friday you also have twice where it's doing an even numbered hour sometime during the 24 hours. And the answer is fine. But given the doshu bei rabim, but people are accustomed to do bloodletting on Friday. Why? Rashi explains, because people were poor. Now, Friday night, they're going to be having a big Suda. Now, besides that we talked about before, that you need to have a Suda right after bloodletting, in addition, the Gemara and Avodah Zarah tells us that the best thing to eat on the day after bloodletting is fish. Now, when are you going to eat fish? Friday night. So there, and that's already Shabbos. So therefore, so if you do bloodletting on Friday, then you'll have your Sheni Ladam there on the day after you did bloodletting. That is to say, that night, you'll be eating fish, and then that's good. So therefore, people are in the habit of doing bloodletting on Friday so that they can, you that way, the fish on Friday night does double duty. And since people do that, and the harm is not so obvious, Shema Psoim Hashem, then we can apply to that the expression in the Pasuk, Hashem guards the simple. In other words, you have, and this is brought in, this is brought la halacha as far as various things. When you have something that's normally done by people and there's only a little bit of a risk involved, then you can do that and you're not obligated to say, overrides anything. To a certain extent, when it comes to normal things that people do, then you can rely on Shema Psoim Hashem, even if, as the Gemara is saying over here, there is a certain degree of risk in it. This has been brought in halacha as far as many other things, where Moshe actually brought it in some of his early tshuvos as far as smoking. But even though there are all kinds of harms known from smoking, you could argue that to a certain extent, it is a commonplace thing, or at least it was when he wrote these tshuvos, and therefore Shema Psoim Hashem could apply. And you have lots of other examples of this kind of thing that are brought in halacha. So even though Friday objectively should be a problem, but in fact it's fine. So therefore you can do on Tuesday or on Friday. So therefore we're saying that the appropriate times therefore come out Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. Sunday and Wednesday you don't have this problem of Madim Bezavi. Tosfos points out actually on Wednesday you do. If you calculate it, it comes out that Madim is during the 12th hour on Wednesday. However, the 12th hour is already 5 to 6 p.m. Tosfos says it's so late in the day that nobody does bloodletting that late in the day anyway. And Rashi points out nobody does it at night either. So the various days when it comes out at night, Madim Bezavi is not a problem either. And the Ran says the 12th hour of the day can already be considered to a certain extent part of the following night. And therefore, again, we wouldn't say the entire Wednesday is off limits because of that. Okay. More on this topic of the schedule for bloodletting, the appropriate days for it. Omer Shmuel, Dalad Duhu Arba, when you have, now we just said Wednesday is a good day for it. However, if that Wednesday is also the fourth day of the month, or Arba Duhu Arbesar, or if it's the 14th of the month, Dalad Duhu Chof Dalad, or if it's the 24th of the month, so anytime that you have a four in the day of the month, or Dalad Daleka Arba Basre, or when you have a Wednesday where there are not 4 days left until the end of the month, Sakanta, all of those are dangerous days to do blooding. So in other words, if, for example, if Wednesday comes out on the 27th or 28th or whatever of the month, Rashi brings another explanation that some say that it means where it's the last Wednesday of the month, but Rashi says that can't be, and Tosfos explains why not, because we already said the 24th. If it's the last, if the 24th is always going to be the last Wednesday of the month, because a Jewish month has maximum 30 days. So that's already included. So therefore, it must be that Daleka Dalad Basra doesn't mean there's a Daleka Arba Basra doesn't mean there's not another Wednesday after it in the month. It means there's not four days left in the month. Okay, continues the Gemara. Rosh Chodesh Vesheni Loi, to do bloodletting on Rosh Chodesh or on the day after Rosh Chodesh, Cholsha, that can make a person weak. Gimel loy sakanta, and if he does it on the third of the month, then it would be an actual danger. So in short, in other words, he shouldn't be doing it during the first 4 days of the month. Rosh Chodesh on the second day of the month are off limits. Gimel, we said, is even worse, and Dalet, we said before, is also dangerous. So do it from Hay on. Mala yomatova chulsha, then if a person does bloodletting on Erev Yom Tov, then it causes him to be weak. Mala yomatova, that's sauta sakanta. But that's with most Yom Tovim. With Shavuos, if a person does bloodletting on Erev Shavuos, then it's actually a danger for him. And therefore, the gozri rabbonin, I call them mala yomatova, mishum mala yomatova, that's sauta. So in fact, the Chachamim made a gzera that you shouldn't do bloodletting on any Erev Yom Tov, because you might, if you do that, you might come to confuse it with doing it on Erev Shavuos, and then there would be a danger. What's the special danger on Erev Yom on Erev Shavuos? Denofik be ziko shmei tvuach. There comes out on that day a wind or a spirit named tvuach or tavuach, and it's so called the ilo kibul Yisrael Torah. Had the Jewish people not received the Torah, now they received it, as we learned earlier, on the 6th or 7th of Sivan. Here we're talking about on Erev Shavuos, which is the 5th of Sivan, but after all, that was the day when they said Mass of Initium. If they hadn't done that, have a tovach l'ulub sarayu l'damayu, it would have shechted and killed their flesh and blood. So therefore, in other words, the fact that you have the spirit, so therefore, still, you have every year that spirit is evoked, because you always have on the anniversary of anything, by Yom Evin Zikaron V'Nasim. So therefore, every year, Erev Shavuos, that spirit is around and about, and therefore, when a person is susceptible because of bloodletting, then it can get it. Marsha points out, Marsha refers to something that he explains in Sanhedrin, where you have something over there. The Gemara mentions a point, kol hazeveach as yitzroi, that if a person shechts as yitzahara, Hashem counts it as though he brought a korban. So Marashah explains over there that has to do with this Gemara over here. Why is the spirit called tevuach? After all, if it was going to be the killer, had they not accepted the Torah, it should be called toiveach, which is the active form of the verb, rather than tavuach, which is the passive form, the one that was shechted. And Marashah says that's the point, because in the end, they did shecht it by saying nasav nishma. But nevertheless, though, the fact is that it still has to do with that, and therefore it's hazardous to do any Erev Shavuos. Again, you know, I mean, besides Bepashtus, we're talking on the most straightforward level. The Gemara is partially giving us medical advice, as it does all over Shas, because, you know, a person needs to be healthy to serve Hashem. But, you know, we can also find in it lessons in Avodah for nowadays when we don't do bloodletting. And it has to do maybe with what we need to do as far as removing some of our tivus, some of our blood, and when that's appropriate to do and when it's not appropriate to do, when we should have that excitement and that taiva for matters of kedusha rather than for matters of olmasa and so forth. Anyway, continues the Gemara. Omer Shmuel, ochal chita behikis dam. If a person ate even one grain of wheat and then he did bloodletting, lo hikis ela lo oisa chita, then all he accomplished with that is removing the effect of his body on his body of that one grain of wheat. In other words, it actually says when a person eats, he feels heavier. So now when he does bloodletting after that, all he accomplishes is he removed that heaviness from his body. In other words, the point is you should be doing it on an empty stomach to have maximum effect. But the Gemara says, now that would only be if the person is doing the bloodletting for healing. So he's actually sick and he's doing bloodletting in order to cure him, then he should be doing it on an empty stomach. But if he's doing it because he needs to lighten his blood, maybe that means, for example, if he has high blood pressure, I don't know, then Makel, it will have that effect. Because the fact is, even if he does it on a full stomach, then nevertheless, it still does that have that effect of removing some of the volume of his blood and therefore removing the high blood pressure or whatever it is that's bothering. Okay. Next, he continues, Hamak is dam, when a person has bloodletting, shsiyala alter, drinking right away, achila ad chatzi mil, and eating up to a half a mil. So we boil the so we have to understand, what does Shmuel mean by that? Shsiyala alter mali, does he mean that drinking immediately after the bloodletting is effective in helping strengthen the body? Ava boso hochi koshi, but if a person waits a while and only then he drinks, then the drinking would be bad for him. Or does Shmuel mean that if you drink right away, it's really good for you? If you wait a while and then you drink, then it's neither here nor there. It doesn't make things worse, but it doesn't help you like it would have right afterwards, but it doesn't hurt things either. And the Gemara leaves that as take, but we're not sure. And also, what about the second half when he says achila ad chatzi mil? So iboilu achila ad chatzi mil hoduka maili. Does it mean that eating up until the amount of time it takes to walk a half a mil after the bloodletting, a mil, you have different opinions among the poskim, anywhere between 18 and 24 minutes, so a half a mil between 9 and 12 minutes. So if you, is Shmuel saying that if you eat within that amount of time after the bloodletting, then it's good for you? But the implication would be that if a person eats sooner than that or later than that, then it would be bad for him. Or again, does Shmuel mean that's the best time to eat where it'll have the good effect? But if you eat less than a half a meal afterwards or more than a half a meal afterwards, it won't hurt you. It won't help, but it won't hurt you. And again, take it. Okay. Gemara says another thing. Machriz Rav. Rav made the following announcement. Mea kori bezuzin. If there are 100 kori of pumpkins, if you have 100 pumpkins selling for one zuz, then it's worth it to buy them. But otherwise, they're not really good food for you, so therefore don't bother. So only if you can get them at a really cheap price. Similarly, he says, Mea reshi bezuzi, if you have 100 heads of animals that are available for one zuz, then go ahead and buy them. But otherwise, don't bother them. Otherwise, don't bother. They're not really healthy to eat. And as far as lips of an animal, don't even supam can mean the Rashi translates it with a French word that means the mustache, but basically animals don't have mustaches, so it means basically the lips. Anyway, if they're selling lips of animals, don't even bother buying them, even if they're giving them away for free. They're not worth anything. So now that's how Rashi puts it, but Tosfos. Says, what does that have to do with our Gemara? We've just been talking about bloodletting the whole time. Why is the Gemara all of a sudden digressing to talk about what kinds of food are good for you and not? So rather, Tosfos brings an explanation from Rabbeinu Hanano, and the Aruch brings something similar with a little more detail. The first word is not kori, but kauni. Kauni means horns, literally, but it refers to the tubes that they used to use for bloodletting. So we're still on the subject of bloodletting. So you would have, for example, you could make a deal with the bloodletter that he will let blood for you 100 times for a flat price of one zuz. So you would say, for example, I'm giving you a flat fee, one zuz, and for that you'll let blood for me as many times as necessary, and then he'll do it even if it's 100 times. And the same thing, Meir Reisha Bezuzah would be the same kind of thing as far as a barber, and then the bloodletters often were barbers in those times also. They say that that's where they get the barber's pole that they have nowadays with the red and white stripes is based on that. But anyway, so the same thing, you might have a bar, you might arrange with a barber to, for a flat fee, you're going to pay him a zuz in advance, and he'll cut your hair as many times as you want during a certain amount of time. But mayas fami veloy klum, but to trim your mustache, that he would do for free, because once you're paying him for bloodletting, or once you're paying him for cutting your hair, then he would throw in trimming your mustache for free. So the Gemara continues. Amar Yosef ki aven and beir Rav Huna. When we used to learn, when we were in Rav Huna's yeshiva learning Torah, yoyim de mefagri beir Rabbanon. When there was a day when the Rabbanon were being mefagri. Now Rashi translates mefagri as they were lazy. They were too lazy to come to the Beis Medrash that day. So the Talmidim who were there would say, Ha'idna yoyim de sfami. Today is a day of lips. I didn't know what they meant. But Rabbi Yosef says, now that we just established that lips of an animal are completely worthless as food, and even if they're selling them, even if they're giving them away for free, you shouldn't bother. Now I understand. They meant basically this was a wasted day. According to Tosfos' explanation, the vote was, since again we're saying that the barber or the bloodletter trims the mustache for free, so what happens if it happens a whole day he happens to have all his customers come for mustache trims, all of them they've previously paid him his flat fee to cut their hair or do their bloodletting, but today punked it happens that all of them come and say we need our mustaches trimmed, so he's putting in a whole day's effort and isn't seeing any money for it, so therefore Tosfos translates mefagri not so much the Chachamim were too lazy to come to the Beis Medrash, but rather that they were tired and they weren't really able to accomplish much in learning. So they would say, it's a Yom HaDesfami, it's like a day, we put in so much effort and nothing, and we don't have really anything to show for. This is, by the way, where we get the expression Yom HaTepagra, when you have a Chassidish Yom Tov, in particular, it's called a Yom HaTepagra, because literally we're saying that the people like slack off on that, people slack off on that day and then go do other things rather than haraving and learning. Okay. The Gemara goes on. Amar of Nachman. So, okay, so now we're done with the matter of bloodletting. Now, the Mishnah had also mentioned the reason we got into this whole thing was because the Mishnah had talked about that you're allowed to assist at childbirth on Shabbos and to do whatever is necessary, even Chilul Shabbos, for the purpose. So we had mentioned you can even make a bonfire to warm up the woman who just gave birth, and that led us into this whole discussion of warming up somebody who had bloodletting done. So now, Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchok, Amar Rav Baravua, Amar Rav, Kola Amar Vaparshas Toichacha Oisim L'chaya B'Shabbos. The rule is, anything that it says in the section of Toichacha, this is Yechezkel Perek Tes Zayin. So Yechezkel starts over there, he describes metaphorically the Jewish people, he describes as a baby abandoned and born and abandoned in the field. And he describes what we're going to quote now from the pasuk, that none of the normal things that are supposed to be done for a baby had been done for her. And then he goes on to say, the psukim we say in the Haggadah, and by a bris, forever a life, the eris, the erch, misbecesses, the damayah, the swallowing in your blood, the oimalach, the damayah,
the damayah. Calm down, no. I'm coming.
And then he continues that eventually I came back when you were grown up, and say this part, and I got also and then he comes and marries her and gives her all kinds of beautiful ornaments and jewelry, and then she goes in his mezana and in a shocking way, and this is all a mashal for what Hashem did for us Jewish people and then how we reciprocated in such an ungrateful way. Anyway, so now we're saying this is called Parashas Toichacha. In fact, it's such a short Toichacha that you even have a Mishnah in Megillah where Rabbi Eliezer says you're not even allowed to use that as Haftorah. The Halacha is technically not like Rabbi Eliezer, and in fact, the Rambam listed his list of Haftorahs for Parashas Shmos, and the Yemenites use it for that, but the Minhag Ashkenaz and Sfar does not too. Anyway, so as Haftorah. So anything that's mentioned in that section, in those psukim, that was not done for the baby in the metaphor, you are allowed to do for the baby and for the mother on Shabbos, because they're all matters. So you have a Tosfos explains that each of these things is not necessarily there's pikuach nefesh involved, but there is tzar. And since there's no isur daraisa in them, then therefore the chachamim are allowing you to do them on Shabbos. On the other hand, you have other rishonim who learn that each one of them does in fact involve pikuach nefesh, and the chiddush is not only that you do them, obviously pikuach nefesh is doicha Shabbos and doicha kol atarda kula, but even the things that you might have to do to prepare for them. Let's say, for example, one of them is going to be to cut the umbilical cord. So let's say you don't have a knife available. Not only you would be able to cut it on Shabbos, so you're allowed to cut the umbilical cord on Shabbos, which according to that opinion, I think the Ran says it would be the Kuach Nefesh, but you're even allowed to bring a knife if you don't have one, because that's necessary in order to prepare for that. Anyway, so Shenemar, the pasuk says, Umildi Sayich, when you were born, B'yom Huledes Oisach, on the day that you were birthed, Loi Choras Shorech, your navel, your umbilical cord was not cut, over Mayim Loruchatz Lamishi, you were not washed with water to smooth you out, to smooth out your skin, V'hom Leach Loihum Lachat, you were not salted. Now that might mean actually salting. That might mean literally sprinkling salt on the baby in order to firm up the skin. That's how Rashi learns it. On the other hand, the Rambam learns that it means not literally salting. It means more like powdering the baby. Anyway, and then the pasuk continues. V'hochte loichutot, and you weren't swaddled. You have when a baby is born, it's the limbs, the joints, or whatever, get out of joint during the birth, and therefore you have to wrap it up tightly in clothing, and then in such a way that everything will get back into its proper place. So let's darshan. Umel desayich v'yom huledes. When it says, as far as the birth on the day that you were born, so from this we learn that you assist at the birth on Shabbos. Again, according to Tosfos, there may not be a malacha daraisa involved, but because of the tzar, it's only a isu derabanan, but because of the tzar, the chacham allowed it. According to the Ran, I think it would be there are malachas daraisa involved, and you're not allowed to do not only the malacha daraisa, but even the preparatory things for it. And the same thing with all the other ones. Loi choras shorech, when Yechezkel was saying that your navel, when your umbilical cord was not cut, From here, we say that you're allowed to cut the umbilical cord on Shabbos. When it says you weren't washed to smooth out your skin, from there you see that you're allowed to bathe the baby, the newborn baby, on Shabbos. You're allowed to salt or powder the baby on Shabbos. And from this, we see that you swaddle the baby on Shabbos. That particular one, Eitz Yosef, refers to, quote, something from Tosfos, in a previous perek. Actually from Rashi over here, that points out there are two different things. There's a Gemara that mentions something called Asubi Yenuka, which is also on Shabbos, which also involves putting all the joints back in place, and that's also on Shabbos. And it's kind of like Boina, here we're saying, so Rashi says we just mean like swaddling, like wrapping up the baby, whereas there we're talking about actual manipulations, and there are several other different opinions among the Rishonim, including one of them being you're allowed to do this right after the birth, as we're saying over here. When we say elsewhere, Asubi Yenuka is also, it would mean on the day after or days after that, whatever. Okay. So now that the perek had ended with the fact that that you assisted a birth on Shabbos and you do everything that's necessary to take care of the baby, the last thing actually that Mishnah at the end of the 18th perek says is you do kol tzorchei mila b'Shabbos. So therefore, now that brings us to an entire perek on the dinim of mila. It starts by focusing on Mila on Shabbos, but it talks about more generally the dinim of Mila in general, because you really don't have any place else in Shas where it talks about it in a concentrated way. So the Mishnah starts off, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Im lo hevi kli me'erev Shabbos, if you hadn't brought the knife for the Mila to the place of the Mila on Erev Shabbos, mevia b'Shabbos megula. Then you can bring it on Shabbos, even through Rosh Hashanah, but you bring it uncovered. Rashi refers to the Gemara that says two possibilities why you should bring it uncovered. One is chibuve mitzvah, to show how precious the mitzvah of Mila is, that it overrides Shabbos. And the other would be because of chashta, that people shouldn't suspect that he's carrying something else on Shabbos. And then he continues, if it's a dangerous time when the goyim are made a gzera against bris milah, then you cover it, but then you have edim, you bring edim along with you, so that way if anybody asks, then you can say that it's a milah knife, you can tell them that it's a milah knife, the edim will be able to testify that it's a milah knife and not that you stand carrying on Shabbos. So that's according to Rabbi Eliezer. The Mishnah goes on to say that Rabbi Akiva disagrees with that and says only the Mila itself is Dorich HaShabbos, the Machshire Mila, the prerequisites for it, such as bringing the knife or making the knife or whatever, are not Dorich HaShabbos. The Halacha is like Rabbi Akiva. So the bottom line is that if you don't have the knife there, or you don't have any of the necessities of the Mila there, then you have to postpone the bris. Tosfos, by the way, brings up the question, why don't you bring the baby to the knife instead of the knife to the baby? Wouldn't there be less Chilul Shabbos involved? And Tosfos discusses not necessarily. First of all, the baby's too little to walk anyway, so you can't really, we learned earlier in the Masechta, there was the concept called Chai Noisei Satsmi, a living creature, or at least a person, is considered to a certain extent to carry themselves because they shift their weight, but an 8-day-old baby is not. And besides, after the bris, he's certainly not going to be able to, in a position to, then he's considered a chola. You know, you have the famous joke, I had a bris mila and then I couldn't walk afterwards for a year. So the baby anyway is going to be a chola. So therefore, so there's not really going to be any less chibul Shabbos by carrying the baby than versus carrying
the night. They're susceptible to getting sick from, so weak and young, fragile to get sick.
Well, that depends what kind of weather we're talking about, I guess, but yeah.
In general,
the fact is, you know, they bring the baby home from the hospital and then you go out, you don't keep the baby at home the whole time. Fact is, after all, if the bris is on a weekday, you bring the baby to shul now. So now the Mishnah actually mentions that Rabbi Eliezer allows you, he goes further. It's left out over here in Ein Yaakov, but the Mishnah goes further and mentions Rabbi Eliezer allows you not only to bring the knife on Shabbos, but even if you don't even have a knife at all, you're allowed to, he says, you can cut wood to burn, to make charcoal in order to make a metal, in order to make a sharp metal thing that you can use for the bris milah. So that's how far he goes as far as allowing machshir and milah on Shabbos. And this applies to other mitzvahs as well. He also holds that the machshirim of them are doicha Shabbos, and each one of those cases, Rabbi Akiva disagrees. Anyway, So the Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Yitzchok, Ir Achas Hoisa be'Eretz Yisrael, Shari Oisim K'Rav Eliezer." There was a certain city in Eretz Yisrael where they used to follow Rav Eliezer. Now, of course, you know, once the halacha has been paskin, like Rav Akiva, then you can't do that. But back before the halacha had been paskin, then the particular cities are allowed to pick to follow his opinion, and they did. V'hoyim Mason Bismanim, and the reward Menashemayim was that people there died in their proper time. Nobody died young. The Marsha says this mida keneged mida. They were careful to even make the knife for the milah on Shabbos to be able to do as much as possible to be able to be mekayim the mitzvah of milah bismana. So therefore, their schus was for that they died bismanam rather than prematurely. Tosfos, by the way, elsewhere explains that it means the people of the city, not just that if it happened that they didn't have the knife, or if it happened that they didn't have the knife, then they would make one or carry one. Tosfos in Yevamos explains that actually what it means is they would deliberately put themselves in that position. If there was a baby born on Shabbos and they knew the bris is going to be the next Shabbos, they would deliberately make sure that there's no knife available where the baby, where in the house where the baby lives, in order that they should have to forge one on Shabbos, and that way be Mekayim what Rabbi Eliezer is saying. But on the face of it, they're doing terrible Chil Shabbos, but because they're following the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, and they're doing it because of, to show how precious the mitzvah of Mila is, therefore, v'hoyim meisim bizmanim. Ian Yaakov adds, you know, look, okay, in the end, the halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer, but they meant l'shem shemayim. So again, as long as the halacha wasn't established otherwise, then they could do that. Not only that, one time the Roman government made a gzera of shmad against Jewish people, specifically against the mitzvah of Mila, but they didn't make the gzera against this particular city. Ion Yaakov says a balabatish reason that you could say for that. Al-Piateva, he says, what happened? So the Goyim were seeing that constantly in the city, they're being Mechawal Shabbos in order to do Bris Milah. So therefore, they said to themselves, so, why should we stop them from doing Bris Milah? Then they're going to be observing their Shabbos more. We might as well have them continue to break their Shabbos, because what their Goyish kept, as far as they knew, it is breaking Shabbos. So therefore they left them alone. Marsha, by the way, points out that you can see a deeper connection between doing Mila Bismana and living a long life. We see that Yitzchak was the first one to have Mila Bismana, and he lived the longest of the others. Whereas Avraham had his Shaloi Bismana, and he passed away 5 years early. So the Gemara continues. Tanya, Reb Shimon Gamliel Omer, Kol mitzvah shekibli Yisrael aleim b'simcha, every mitzvah that the Jewish people accepted on themselves happily, to go in Mila, for example, the mitzvah of Mila, dichtiv, on which the pasuk says, "Sos anoichi al masecha," I am happy about your saying. We say that pasuk at a bris Mila for that reason, because it refers to bris Mila. So I die in ois and ois of besimcha. Still to this very day, the Jewish people do that mitzvah besimcha. How does sos anoichi al masecha? What tells us that it refers particularly to Mila? So Rashi explains. First of all, the word imrasecha is in the singular. So it suggests one mitzvah that was said before all the other ones, and that would be Bris Milah, which was given to Avraham Avinu long before the rest of the Torah was given to the Jewish people. So we're sos anoichi, and the reason for that happiness is because it's constantly with us, 24/7. You have the famous story Rashi brings from Menachos, where David HaMelech was once in the bathhouse, and he was terribly disturbed over the fact that he has no mitzvahs with him, and then he realized he has the Bris Milah with him constantly, and he was happy about that. So therefore, for the same reason, we're happy about it. So therefore, that's what makes us happy. In fact, Marsha says that's why the end of the pasuk continues kimotze shalol rov, like we find great spoils, great booty, because in other words, it's like spoils that you win in war without even having to put much effort into getting them. The same way you have a mitzvah that you have without even having to have put in any effort for it, and you have it with you 24/7. Elsewhere, Rashi explains a different explanation why Mila is called Imrasecha, because it's introduced. Hashem, it's introduced in the pasuk by Yomer Elikim al Avraham, rather than most mitzvahs are introduced by Dabar Hashem al Moshe Lein. On the other hand, continues Reb Shimon Gamliel, V'chol mitzvah shekibul aleim b'ktota. On the other hand, any mitzvah that the Jewish people accepted on them in a quarrelsome way, kigoin arayis, for example, the mitzvah that you're not allowed to marry your close relative, dichtiv, and we know that the Jewish people complained about it when it was first given, dichtiv, the pasuk says, in Ba'al Oischa, Vayishma Moshe, Moshe heard the people crying by their families. And that means al-iske mishpachosav. That means not just they were complaining about that they didn't have meat, as it has in the psukim over there. They were also complaining about the fact that they couldn't marry their close relatives anymore, and that anybody who had married their close relatives had to divorce them. So they were very upset about that. Marshoi and Yuma gives a reason for it, because after all, we're on the face of it, if you're able to marry within your family, it means it would be much easier to make shidduchim. For one thing, there won't be a lot of monetary component in it. You were like this, you always have, you have to have a nadan, and you have to have those arguments over who's going to pay for what at the wedding. If you're marrying a close relative, then the mechotanim are them themselves, and therefore you have less of a problem. In fact, Marshal says over there, there's an opinion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I think it's even accepted by Halacha, that a ben noyach is allowed to marry his own daughter. Well, in that case, if they were complaining, if we were still considered like bnei noyach, then we'd certainly have no problem with nadans and shidduchim and getting the in-laws to be to get along and so forth. Anyway, so they accepted it only with complaint. Adayin oisin oisibiktata, to this very day, marriage involves argument, delaka ksuba delay robu batigra, because there's no ksuba that doesn't involve some argument between the two sides. There's a story in that connection they tell about, I think it's the Chozim Lublin, that one time he was invited to be Masaduk, he was in the Masaduk Kedushin at a wedding, and he took an exceptionally long time davening Mincha. So afterwards they asked him why. He said, you have this Gemara over here, so what's the deeper reason behind it? Why Taka, is there always some kind of argument involving a wedding? Because Min HaShemayim is determined not only who's going to marry who, but the exact moment when they're going to get married. Well, of course, people don't usually know when that exact moment is that was decided Min HaShemayim. So they set a time, whatever's convenient, and they put it on the invitations. But if it's before the time that it's supposed to be Min HaShemayim, then that time has to be filled up, for example, with arguments. So he says, I knew that, so therefore I daven Mincha, better to fill up the time with that.
He knew it was coming.
He knew it was coming, yeah. Anyway, so the point is that we see that Mila was accepted to begin with Besimcha, and therefore to this very day we do the mitzvah of Mila Besimcha. And we'll continue next time, Be'ez Hashem, with more all about Mila. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Yod Beis 7, the end of Tashlumen of Chag HaShavuos. So even after the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed, we still have what we can complete of the avoda of Shavuos up till and including Yud Beis Sivan. This was a letter that Emma wrote on Yud Beis Sivan. So we're standing on the last day of Tashlumim of Atzeres, of Zman Matan Teresenu, and as we know, this is all the days of Tashlumim, and even in Chutz Laaretz, therefore we don't say Tachnun during those days. So that shows that even after the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed, and even when we're in Chutz Laaretz, and there's no Korbanos to begin with in Chutz Laaretz, nevertheless, the concept of Yemei Tashlumim still exists. And that gives us a hira as far as a person's avoda, that a person has the opportunity during those times, the opportunity and the strength during those times to be able to complete and finish up. If for whatever reason he's lacking something on Yom Matan Torah itself, and you have the concept that the Gemara said that Hakom Moedim Batzeres to be in Lachem, everybody agrees that you have to have an aspect of Lachem, you have to have enjoyment for the Gashmi stick of body on Yom Kippur. So therefore, you have all the opportunity to make up for all of that, anything that was missing on Shavuos during these days, including things involving the Guf and the Simcha of the Guf. And up to and including your base, which is today. Continuing with Hilchos Maaseh U'Matan. So we were talking about that you have to weigh and measure honestly, and there's serious consequences, serious punishments, min hashamayim, for not doing so. So now, actually, when you're measuring or when you're weighing, you need to actually add a little bit extra. You need to be a little bit generous with the measurement. That's the pasuk says, Evan Shleim of Tzedek. So that means Tzedek Meshocha B'Ten Loi, add a little bit extra for him. In general, though, you have to measure the way that it's done in the country without changing. And you have examples. They used to measure in those times differently. They would sell heaped measures, sometimes flat measures. So you have to do the appropriate way. And in fact, the Rosh HaKohol have to be responsible to set up people who are going to go around to the stores and make sure that nobody has false weights or measures or inaccurate scales or whatever. And if they do, then they need to make them pay consequences as appropriate, whether it involves hitting them or penalizing them or what have you.